Why has Luke written this account? That's the question. That's the question for us. Why has Luke written this account? You're going to want to follow along. So if you have a Bible, Luke chapter 1, verses 1 through 4. If you don't have a Bible, you can just Google Luke 1, 1 through 4. We're reading from the English Standard Version. It'll just help you track with us. Well, why? What's the point of this gospel, big picture-wise? Well, you can see it right there in verses 3 and 4. Right? We'll pick it up in verse 3, and we'll see it there in verse 4. Luke said, "It seemed good to me also, having followed all things closely for some time, to write an orderly account for you, most excellent Theophilus, that you might have," what? Y'all aren't awake yet. Let's try that again. "That you might have," what? "Certainty concerning the things you've been taught." Okay, that's the goal of Luke's gospel. Luke wants to give Theophilus and all other Theophiluses certainty concerning what they've been taught about Jesus, or maybe what they haven't been taught about Jesus. That's the goal of Luke's gospel. He wants to give us certainty. You might say it this way: Luke's gospel is for those in search of certainty. Luke's gospel is for those in search of certainty. Now, look, let me ask you, do you want certainty about the Christian faith, about Jesus, about the good news, as Christians call it? Well, then Luke's gospel, friends, is for you. Now, maybe this surprises you. Certainty, really? I thought Christians were people of faith. But certainty? Well, yes, friends, Christians are people of faith. That is, of course, true. We're called to believe the good news. We're called to believe in Jesus. But what is faith? How do you define it? Is faith believing something when there's absolutely no rational reason you should believe it? I hope not, because that sounds a lot more like foolishness than the biblical definition of faith. Is faith blind trust, just a leap in the dark? Again, I hope not. Well, Hebrews 11:1, as we saw, says faith is the assurance of things hoped for. It's a conviction of things not seen. Notice the two words he uses to define faith in Hebrews 11:1. He says assurance and conviction. Faith is assurance and convictions, which means, friends, that faith and certainty are not enemies, they're friends. Faith is trust in the Lord based on certainty and assurance of his promises and the certainty and assurance of his word. Does that describe your faith? It should, friends, because we need certainty. Certainty is maybe, lack of certainty is maybe why some people never become Christians, right? The Bible, they may look at the Bible and say, there's obviously some good things in the Bible, right? But I just don't think I can be certain or confident that it's true, right? Lack of certainty is maybe why many Christians are weak and half committed, right? If we're going to actually commit ourselves to Jesus and follow him, can you do that without certainty? Some people never get serious about their faith because if they drill down into their heart and they're honest, there's some doubts that gnaw at them. There's some doubts that are a rock in the shoe constantly. If we're going to be people who sacrificially live for Jesus and live on mission, share the gospel with others, can you really honestly do that without certainty about this, right? Can you really say no to the pleasures of sin, the temptations of the world, if you don't have certainty in the promises of God, in the goodness of God? For Christians who suffer deeply and have seen others suffer deeply, just because of the brokenness of this world, how can you stand unless you have a stable and sure rock to stand on, right? That's what certainty is meant to do for you. It's what it's meant to be for you. It's meant to be the thing that holds your faith and sustains you. And for all of us, outside of the certainty of God's word, our lives are so uncertain, aren't they, and unpredictable, that we need the certainty of God's word in the midst of it. In the midst of it all, to anchor us, don't we? Now, don't misunderstand me. Certainty doesn't mean you get all the answers. Doesn't mean you get all the answers. There are many unanswered questions we will live with to our graves about why the Lord allowed this, or why the Lord allowed that, or why this area of my life was so difficult, or why that person died at what seems to everybody else to be the worst time to die, right? Certainty does not mean we get all of our questions answered, but we get enough to hold on to, right? We get enough certainty to hold on to the truth, to persevere to the end, and walk with the Lord and trust in Him, okay? So Luke's gospel is for those in search of certainty. Are you in search of certainty? If you're a non-Christian, I hope you're in search of certainty. If you're a Christian, I hope you're in search of more certainty to strengthen your faith, sustain you. Because, friends, we need it, right? There's things, all kinds of things in this world that we need certainty to do, right? Like when you're coming up to a stoplight, you need certainty that what? Your brakes are going to work when you push down the brake pedal, right? Anyone crazy enough to go skydiving, you need certainty, at least a good amount of it, to be sure that parachute's going to deploy, right? And it's the same way with the Christian faith. You got to have certainty with this thing. Positive thinking, wishful thinking, good feelings is not enough to sustain faith in the real world, friends. It might be cute, but it doesn't work. We're not here to play games. We need certainty about this thing. Okay, but who's Theophilus, right? Right? Luke said in verse 3, that he's written these things to most excellent Theophilus. Who is Theophilus? Well, Theophilus was likely, we don't know for sure who he is, but he was likely a high-standing Roman official in the first century. We know that because Luke addresses him as most excellent Theophilus, right? The only other places we get in the New Testament the names most excellent are at the end of the book of Acts, and in both cases it refers to a Roman governor. Most excellent Felix, most excellent Festus are two governors that Paul speaks to, okay? And so this is a high-standing Roman official of some rank, we don't know, and he's either an unbeliever or a new believer. We also don't know that for sure. He's been taught about the good news of the gospel, but he's still somebody who is in search of certainty, right? You can imagine he's hearing all these things about Jesus and he's wrestling with this stuff and he's wondering, was Jesus really born of a virgin? Like, really? Is that true? Amen. Did he really show grace to tax collectors, the worst of the worst? Did he really walk on water? Like, come on. Did he really heal people with just a word? Did he really come to seek and save lost people? Are Gentiles and are non-Jews really welcomed into the kingdom of God? Did Jesus really rise from the dead? Come on, Luke, this stuff sounds crazy. But I almost believe it. And many people think that Theophilus actually sponsored Luke's work as a patron and told him to go do as much research as he could and write an account for him. Right? Because in the ancient world, when accounts like this were written, and you have a person mentioned in the prologue to a biography like this, that person was usually the sponsor of the work. He was the patron. Because work like this takes a long time to investigate, as we're going to see. Why would Theophilus sponsor Luke and invest in Luke doing this research? Well, because Theophilus needed certainty, especially as a high-standing Roman official who may very well suffer deeply if he becomes a Christian in the Roman Empire. What's interesting, though, is that the name Theophilus means lover of God. And even though Theophilus was undoubtedly a real person, there's a sense in which Luke is writing to give all lovers of God certainty about the Christian faith. Why? Well, because, friends, we need certainty in order to take our faith seriously. An uncertain faith, friends, is an insincere faith. It's a faith that's not serious. We need certainty if we're going to really love God the way we're called to. The question, though, is how does Luke's prologue give us certainty? That's the question. How, right? Great, Luke, you want to give us certainty, but how are you going to do this in this gospel? Well, in this introduction, in these first four verses, he gives us a little bit of an outline of how he intends his gospel to give us certainty in the Christian faith, right? And we can see in this prologue four criteria that Luke gives us about his gospel, about this biography of Jesus that is meant to give us certainty. It's meant to put rebar in our faith and strengthen us. It's meant to give us confidence, assurance, that this thing's not some cute fairy tale, that it's historical information about Jesus who came to seek and save sinners. So there's four criteria of certainty that we see. Let's go. The first criteria is that Luke speaks of many accounts in verse 1. Look at verse 1 and 2 together. Luke says, inasmuch as many have undertaken, notice the words many, inasmuch as many have undertaken to compile a narrative of the things that have been accomplished among us, just as those who were from the beginning were eyewitnesses and ministers of the word have delivered them to us, it seemed good to me also to write an orderly account for you. So before Luke even gets to his own work, he mentions what? He says, there's many who have undertaken to compile a narrative of the things that have been accomplished on us. There's many accounts of this. And this should encourage us. Luke is telling us that his message and content are not new. There's no originality with Luke. Well, maybe a little bit, but the gist of it is not new. He says there have been many who have compiled a narrative of the life of Jesus. And Luke is placing his work alongside those existing works, right? Notice that Luke, he doesn't criticize the other works. In ancient history, when somebody would produce a new work of history and they have in the prologue, they often take jabs at the other works to justify the reason for their own work, right? Their own contribution. Luke doesn't do that. He says there have been many people who have put together narratives of the life and story of Jesus. And my work is just an addition to those existing works. Some of those works, friends, we know about today. Some of them, many of them, we probably don't. But we know that Luke was probably at least aware of Matthew and Mark and had read them in his own research. But the point is that the events of the life of Jesus were not simply recorded by a few people. Now, that's good news. If Luke's gospel was a one-off telling us stuff about what Jesus said and did, and nobody else agreed with him, what should we do? We should not believe it. Right? We should not believe it. We should dismiss it. It would call into question Luke's claims. But Luke is adding his work to a pile of other works to give us confidence, right? If you go into a news station, you see that there's a story on that news station that is on no other news station. That story might be true, right? But you also might wonder, is this fake news? Right? Is this fake news? But then when you flip through several other news stations and they're all talking about the same event, you say, you know something big happened. Nobody's questioning the veracity of that event, right? And that's what Luke's saying here. He said, guys, Luke, Theophilus, there's been many people writing about this. I'm just adding my work to the already existing work. That's the sense we're supposed to have here. Luke says a lot of people are writing about Jesus. Why? Well, because, friends, Jesus himself was such a big deal. He left such a mark on people that people felt compelled and stirred to write about him. The fact that we have a whole New Testament written about Jesus from 2,000 years ago is stunning. It is absolutely stunning. I know we take it for granted. You know, we stick our Bible on ourselves like, that's the New Testament. No, no, no. That's not the New Testament. That's the New Testament. That is a whole bookload of historical documents we have about Jesus. You want to know how big of a deal that is? The fact that we have a whole New Testament and the fact that we have four biographies of Jesus in the New Testament is incredible. Many people get hung up on the fact that the four Gospels have what seem to be contradictions. Like, why don't they match up perfectly? Well, criminal investigators today get suspicious when everyone's story is exactly the same, right? Because it's evidence of collusion. Like, they clearly got together and made all the details match, right? And so we're here, like, why don't they match? And for many people, it's the reason they dismiss the Bible. But friends, actually, the fact that they don't match up perfectly, the differences there are actually evidence of authenticity and credibility. Like, you get three different news sources covering the same basketball game, what's going to happen? You might read those three different news sources and say, those were three different games, right? Or more commonly, what would happen is they're all going to talk about different aspects of the game, right? There's, of course, going to be common highlights, which is exactly what the Gospels have, but there's going to be differences in emphasis as well. And that's what we see in the four Gospels. That's what's happening there. But the fact that we have four biographies of Jesus in the New Testament is incredible. And then a whole New Testament also talking about him. Just to give you a sense of how significant that is, there was only one other person from that era that has four biographies written about him. You know who it was? Tiberius Caesar. So you have Jesus, and you have the richest and most powerful man in the world. Here's what's even crazier, though. The guys who were writing about Tiberius Caesar, the four biographies about him, were not talking just about him. They were talking about emperors in general, and they included him in their biographies, right? The biographies of Jesus were only about Jesus. The biographies of Jesus were also written much closer to the life and death of Jesus than the biographies of Tiberius. In other words, the biographies of Jesus are historically better quality than even those of Tiberius. What was it about Jesus, though? Well, at the end of verse 1, Luke gives us a clue. He said they wrote about the things that had been accomplished among us. In other words, it wasn't just who Jesus was, but it was what he did that led to such writing about him. We're going to come back to that. But how do we know Luke's account or any of these other accounts that are in our Bible are reliable, are historically reliable? How do we know that, right? How do we know they're accurate? Well, that brings us to our second criteria. Luke says in verse 2 that these are eyewitness accounts. So there's many accounts, and they're eyewitness accounts. Look again at verses 1 and 2. Luke says, inasmuch as many have undertaken to compile a narrative of the things that have been accomplished among us, verse 2, just as those who from the beginning were what? Eyewitnesses and ministers of the word, they have delivered them to us. Luke's point, friends, is that these accounts are based on eyewitness testimony. Now, two of our Gospels in the New Testament are written by men who were disciples of Jesus. That's Matthew and John. They were eyewitnesses. They were there. They're not interviewing somebody else. They were there with Jesus. They heard him teach. They saw him heal. They saw him die. Saw him alive. Mark was not written by an eyewitness, but best we can tell from tradition, it was written by a man named John Mark, who is a traveling companion of Peter. So it's directly tied to an eyewitness. Many people think Mark's gospel was dictated by Peter to John Mark, as he was writing this. Go read Mark's gospel with that in mind and see. You'll notice some funny things said about Peter. Like, you can imagine Peter telling the story, and John Mark's like, oh, that's going in there. Peter's like, are you serious? You wrote that down? He's like, oh, yeah. They're all going to know. And Luke acknowledges that he was not an eyewitness of these things. Luke was a traveling companion of Paul in the book of Acts. He was a doctor. At the end of 2 Timothy, Paul says, everybody's abandoned me except Luke. He's here with me. And so Luke had a close relationship with Paul, who was an eyewitness of the resurrected Jesus. But Luke also says in verse 2 that, again, those who were from the beginning eyewitnesses and ministers of the word deliver these things to us. Not just to them, but to us. What Luke is telling us is that he got his information from those who were eyewitnesses from the beginning. This is so important because it tells us a few things right off the bat, right? First, it tells us that these documents are historically credible, right? So let's go back to Emperor Tiberius, right? Tiberius Caesar. He had four biographies written about him, big deal, historically. But do you know what historians say about those four biographies? They typically don't trust them that much. They read them with a skeptical eye because the accounts were written up to 100 years or more after the death of Tiberius, and they primarily relied on secondary sources rather than eyewitnesses. Friends, the Gospels of the New Testament, Luke's Gospel, are completely different. Completely different. Categorically different. Their direct reliance on primary sources is about as credible as it gets, save something written by somebody who was there. Second, it tells us that the Gospels were not legend or exaggeration. We know this because they were writing their accounts while the eyewitnesses were still alive. Right? If their writings were false or exaggerative or dishonest in any way in their representation of these accounts, the eyewitnesses themselves would discredit the writings. How do we know that? Because, friends, that has happened in history repeatedly. Have you ever heard of Kit Carson? Oh, of course you have. Practically legendary. Kit Carson was a famous frontiersman, wilderness guide, and soldier in the mid-1800s. That's true. That's all true. But the Kit Carson that lived in the imagination of many Americans was a complete myth. See, more than 70 dime novels were written about him during his lifetime, and some shortly thereafter. He was portrayed as this larger-than-life Western hero. The only problem was that there was a grain of truth in it, but a whole lot of exaggeration. It was false. How do we know that all these dime novels falsely represented Kit Carson? Well, because Kit Carson himself tells us. He was alive as the legend circulated, right? He came face to face with his own myth numerous times. One time when he was on the trail, he met a man from Arkansas. And the man said to him, "I say, are you Kit Carson?" To which Carson said, "Yes." The man looked Carson up and down for a moment and said, "You ain't the kind of Kit Carson I'm looking for." Can you imagine that? I mean, these books portray Carson as this like tall, handsome, gunslinging Western hero who was eloquent. And the actual Kit Carson was 5'5", bull-legged, illiterate, soft-spoken. Oh, he was a gunslinger, all right. He was a fighter. He was a skilled frontiersman, skilled wilderness guide. He rode hundreds and hundreds of miles on the Santa Fe Trail. But the actual Kit Carson was much different than the way he was represented. On one occasion, he trailed an American woman who was captured. And when he finally found her dead, he found among her stuff a newly published book about himself. And he was illiterate, of course, so some of his guys who traveled with him read it. And at first, he was amused by the depictions of himself, like, wow, that made me sound pretty good. And then he was ultimately disgusted by it because he realized this woman was probably reading about this fabulous character named Kit Carson who was going to come rescue her. And she found herself disappointed that the real Kit Carson did not. And then another time, again, somebody was reading a book about himself to him. And he was disgusted. He said it was full of lies. He said they laid it on a little too thick, which was Kit Carson's way of saying that's total rubbish, because he was pretty mild-spoken. Towards the end of his life, he actually dictated an autobiography about himself to set the record straight from all the dime novels. What's the point? The point is that's what happens when legend is propagated while eyewitnesses are alive. People don't like being lied about. Friends, that is categorically not what the Gospels are. They were written by people while the eyewitnesses were alive. Even Paul in 1 Corinthians 15 says, more than 500 people saw Jesus alive at the same time. Most of them are still alive. You can go talk to them. Now, it could be easily said, okay, but the eyewitnesses of Jesus, the disciples of Jesus, they have an agenda. And so their writings are biased and it would cause them to skew the truth. Friends, of course they have an agenda. Come on, everybody has an agenda. People don't come to the table with totally neutral presuppositions. Nobody does. Neutrality is a myth. Of course they have an agenda. They want everybody who reads to believe in Jesus and be saved. But that doesn't mean their information is skewed or dishonest. We know that because when we read the Gospels, they leave all the embarrassing bits in there. For example, these biographies of Jesus were written with information primarily from who? Y'all awake? I need to stop saying it. They were written primarily with information from the disciples of Jesus, the apostles. And yet, how do these documents portray the apostles and disciples? Do they portray them as heroes? Not at all. The Gospels make every single one of them look like idiots. And while it's entertaining to read about, right? About Peter with the foot-shaped mouth and about the guys who meet the Samaritans and are like, Lord, can we cast down thunder on them? And Jesus is like, are you kidding me? It's entertaining to read about, but it's also a hallmark of authenticity that the embarrassing bits aren't curated out, right? Because if somebody was writing a story about you, or if you were writing a story about you, if your spouse is writing the story about you, it'd be just so funny, right? If you were writing a story about you, you'd curate it a bit, wouldn't you? All the stupid things you said, Those are all there. The Gospels present the truth in all of its embarrassing connotations. I mean, in the ancient world, the women were the first ones to discover the empty tomb. And in the ancient world, in the first century, women were considered unreliable in court. So if they were going to fabricate this, they'd certainly take that part out. Right? They left it in there because they said, we're not trying to skew this at all. We're presenting the truth however it's going to be perceived. So yes, the Gospels clearly have an agenda. Luke's Gospel has an agenda. But that doesn't mean he's skewing the truth. And what's interesting about Luke's gospel in particular is that he usually just tells the reader what happened without any of his own commentary on it. Like Matthew, if you read the gospel of Matthew, here's what Matthew does. Something happens, and Matthew quotes an Old Testament verse and says, this happened to fulfill that verse, right? He's constantly pointing to the Old Testament to show how the life of Jesus fulfilled the Old Testament. Luke doesn't do that. Luke tells the story as is, what Jesus said, what Jesus did, what happened. Period. End of story. And he leaves the reader to wrestle with what that means. So this is based on eyewitness investigation. It's based on eyewitness testimony. Well, that brings us to the third criteria. We've seen there are many accounts. We've seen their eyewitness accounts. And the third criteria is these. I'm sorry, guys. I'm having trouble talking. The third criteria is that these accounts are carefully investigated. Look at verse 3. Luke says, it seemed good to me also, having followed all things closely for some time past, to write an orderly account for you, most excellent Theophilus. Luke doesn't just tell us that they got their information from eyewitnesses. He says, I've followed these things closely for a long time. Now, the word followed could also be translated as investigated. Maybe that's what your translation says that you're reading. Luke says, here's what Luke's saying. Luke's saying, I've investigated these things for myself. And notice he doesn't just say he's investigated them. He says, I've investigated all things. I've followed all things closely. In other words, this was not a quick and sloppy inquiry. It was thorough. It was detail-oriented. It was time-consuming. And it was probably the fact that it was probably the very time-consuming nature of it that leads us to believe that Theophilus was a patron of this work and a sponsor, right? This type of investigation, especially in the ancient world, takes time and money and resources. The type of time, money, and resources that a Roman official could sponsor and help supply to get an account to provide certainty. Luke functioned, friends, in many ways like an investigative journalist. His gospel is much more like a historical research paper than a mythical novel, right? Even his introduction reads like ancient historical documents that we would read at the beginning of Josephus or someone else. Luke did a lot of digging. He interviewed many people. He asked lots of questions. If you begin reading Luke's work, you'll notice that he tells us stuff about people that he could have only gotten from direct conversation with those people. Did you notice that, maybe? For example, Luke tells us about the words of the angel to the shepherds in the middle of the night. Right? Remember that all the way back at Christmas time, 3 years ago? He tells us about what the angel said to the shepherds and what the shepherds said to each other. Was Luke there? No. Luke tells us about Mary, Jesus' mom, and what she was thinking when the shepherds showed up after Jesus was born. Luke tells us about their trip to Jerusalem when Jesus was 12 and how they headed home and realized Jesus wasn't with them. And he tells us how exasperated they were. Who do you think Luke got that information from? From conversations with these people. Luke probably talked with Jesus' own mother. In his research, Luke tells us about times where it was only Jesus and the three of his closest disciples together. Where do you think Luke got that information from? Do you think Luke met with the disciples of Jesus, John, Peter, and James, and asked them questions about what they saw and heard? You bet he did. Luke tells us the thoughts of Pharisees when Jesus did or said certain things, right? How would Luke know that, right? Well, because he's the narrator and he's, all-knowing, right? Because narrators are all-knowing in fiction. Luke's goal is not to write a fictional narrative. Did Luke spend time with the Pharisees and the scribes, asking them about what they saw and heard as they interacted with Jesus? Friends, I'm sure he did. Again, somebody could claim that Luke is just making stuff up, but friends, many, if not most of the people he wrote about were still alive and could easily discredit what he had said. Additionally, Luke writes about stuff in his gospel that we don't get from any of the other gospels, which testifies to the breadth and depth of his investigation, right? Like only Luke tells us about the parable of the prodigal son and the parable of the persistent widow and the parable of the Pharisee and the tax collector praying in the temple together. Only Luke tells us about the wee little man Zacchaeus who climbed a sycamore tree, right? Only Luke tells us about the thief on the cross next to Jesus who said to Jesus, "Remember me when you come into your kingdom." And Jesus said, "Truly, I say to you, today you'll be with me in paradise." Only Luke tells us about that. Luke's done some research here. Also, Luke's gospel is written in an orderly way. That's what he tells us in verse 3. He says, "I followed all things closely and I wanted to write an orderly account for you, most excellent Theophilus," right? A Roman official is not going to accept some trash writing trying to detail the life of Jesus. He wrote it with a logical flow to it. Sometimes things in Luke's gospel are not chronological, but they are logical. It's why some of the things in Matthew's gospel and in Luke's gospel are in a different order, right? Luke's written in a logical order, not a chronological order. He's thoughtful in the way he arranges it. The Greek style in which Luke writes is the most polished Greek in the New Testament. Luke's writing is scholarly, not folksy. From every conceivable angle, friends, Luke's account bears the marks of somebody who is credible, well-educated, and well-researched. A man named William Ramsey was an archaeologist and New Testament scholar in the early 1900s. And he was considered a world expert in his field of study. You say, "Oh, great, an archaeologist and a New Testament scholar. That's great." Not great. He was taught and believed that most of the New Testament was a myth. And especially that Luke, as a historian, was unreliable. As part of his archaeological research, he set out to disprove and discredit the book of Luke and Acts through archaeological fieldwork. Well, after years of literally digging up evidence, William Ramsey completely changed his mind. Listen to what he said. He said, "Luke is a historian of first rank. Luke is a historian of the first rank. Not merely are his statements of fact trustworthy, he is possessed of the true historic sense. He seizes the important and critical events and shows their true nature at greater length, while he touches lightly or omits entirely much that was valueless for his purpose. In short, this author should be placed along with the very greatest of historians." This is not some hack saying this. This is a world-renowned New Testament scholar who was taught and believed for years that the New Testament was mythical and unreliable until he began trying to dig up and follow all of Luke's historical evidence. And he changed his mind. He said, "Luke is a historian of the first rank." Well, that brings us to the fourth criteria of certainty. Things accomplished. Things accomplished, right? We've seen that there are many accounts. They're eyewitness accounts. We've seen that they are accounts that have been investigated. And now we see that there's things accomplished that Luke and these other writers are talking about. Look again at verse 1. Luke says, "Inasmuch as many have undertaken to compile a narrative of the things accomplished, of the things that have been accomplished among us." In other words, the content of these writings are the things that have been accomplished. Friends, the Gospel of Luke is not about what you must accomplish. It's about what Jesus has accomplished. Not about what you must do, it's about what he has done for you. That's what the Gospels are about. Now, the word accomplished literally means fulfilled. And if you're, again, if you're reading a different translation, maybe that's the way yours reads. What Luke is writing about is how Jesus fulfilled all the promises and prophecies of the Old Testament scriptures. Now, this is amazing because Luke's saying all this stuff I'm writing about is not just based on eyewitnesses. It's not just based on research and investigation that I've done. It's not just based on something that has happened as a flash in the pan in the first century. All this stuff actually goes back to the prophecies and promises of the scriptures thousands of years before Jesus even showed up. And this is powerful because it shows us that Jesus didn't just show up on the scene out of nowhere and make a big impact and then leave. No, Jesus showed up in light of the Old Testament promises and prophecies. The Old Testament, for thousands of years, had been constantly pointing to a coming Messiah. The Old Testament, friends, is by nature an incomplete book that predicted, prophesied, and pointed to a coming Messiah. It's a book that left Israel waiting and waiting for the one promised. All throughout the Old Testament, there's this messianic wind blowing about this mysterious figure who's going to come and fulfill the hopes and longing of the people. God's people were waiting for and longing for and watching for this promised person. And to make sure they got the guy right, there were all kinds of prophecies about what he would do. And friends, when we look at the life of Jesus, when scholars look at the life of Jesus, it is estimated, it's debated, but it's estimated conservatively that he fulfilled more than 300 Old Testament prophecies in his time on earth. Many of them are so obvious that you cannot read the Old Testament prophecy without thinking of Jesus, right? Isaiah 53 is one of those passages. People have called Isaiah 53 the torture chamber of the rabbis because its depictions of Jesus' death and suffering are so powerful and they're so vivid and they're so in keeping with everything that we read about in the New Testament. Yet it was written 600 years before Jesus showed up. But it isn't just that Jesus fulfilled a bunch of scattered prophecies here and there. Luke is saying that Jesus is the fulfillment of the whole Old Testament. The story was always about him. He's the point of it. He's the fulfillment of it. He's the missing puzzle piece that makes all of it make sense, right? The promises pointed to him. The patterns pointed to him. The sacrifices pointed to him. The temple pointed to him. The law pointed to him. The characters prefigured him. The prophecies promised him. The whole Old Testament, friends, is about Jesus. And the New Testament shows how Jesus fulfills it. Friends, you can't, once you see the life of Jesus and consider it and study it, and then you go back and read the Old Testament, you can't not see him, right? One author wrote this: Jesus is the true and better Adam who passed the test in the garden. His garden is a much tougher garden, and his obedience is credited to us. Jesus is the true and better Abel who, though innocently slain, has blood that cries out, not for our condemnation, but for our acquittal. Jesus is the true and better Abraham who answers the call of God, who leaves the familiar comforts of the world into the void, not knowing where he went. Jesus is the true and better Isaac, who is not only offered by his father on the mount, but who was truly sacrificed for us all. Well, God said to Abraham, "Now I know you truly love me because you did not withhold your son, your only son, from me." Now we at the foot of the cross can say to God, "Now we know that you love us because you did not withhold your son from us." Jesus is the true and better Jacob who wrestled and took the blows of justice that we deserved so that we, like Jacob, could only receive the wounds of grace that wake us up and disciple us. Jesus is the true and better Joseph who is at the right hand of the king and forgives those who betrayed him and sold him and uses his power to save them. Jesus is the true and better Moses who stands in the gap between the people and the Lord and mediates the new covenant. Jesus is the true and better Rock of Moses who was struck with the rod of God's justice, now gives us water in the desert. Jesus is the true and better Job. He is the truly innocent sufferer who then intercedes for and saves his stupid friends. And friends, that's just a sampling. We could go on and on. Christ is our true priest. He's our true sacrifice, true temple, true altar. He is a true prophet and true king, friends. The whole Bible has always pointed to Jesus. And Luke is pointing back to it, and he's saying, Jesus didn't just show up. It's not just that I've investigated this. It's not just that there's eyewitnesses. It's that he is fulfilling the picture that we've been given for thousands of years about the promised Messiah. Nobody else meets his criteria, guys. The whole Bible points to Jesus. He is the fulfillment of it. He's the point of it. He is the one who accomplished it all, friends. The Bible in the book of Luke is not about you and what you must do. It's about what Jesus has done for you and how you must believe it and receive it with certainty. He came. He obeyed the law. He loved God and neighbor perfectly. He took our sin upon himself, died the death we deserve. He rose again as the conqueror who tramples over death. He was exalted to God's right hand to reign as the promised king, and he saves all who call upon him in faith. Your job is to believe in him who did what you cannot do. Luke says, I've written these things. There are many accounts of Jesus from eyewitnesses that show he was fulfilled, that show that he was the fulfillment of the Old Testament. I've carefully researched this, Luke says. I've investigated it. So you, Theophilus, can have certainty. Luke's gospel is for those in search of certainty. Is that you? Peel back the layers here and see what's underneath the writing of Luke's gospel. Pop the hood so that you can see if this thing's authentic or not. Do whatever kind of digging you need to do, and you'll see that through and through, there's authenticity, eyewitnesses, research, historical credibility here. Just so you, lovers of God, can have certainty of the things you've been taught, friends. That's the goal of Luke's gospel. Now let's keep that in mind as we continue preaching through Luke's gospel, looking at all the things Luke is telling us, all the people he interviewed, all the research he did here. Let's pray. Lord, we thank you for your word. Pray that you would use this message to strengthen the faith of many and to grant faith to those who don't have faith, Lord. They would run to you, Jesus, and trust in you. They would be honest with themselves, Lord, and wrestle with this, Lord. Help the certainty you give us through Luke's gospel sustain us in trials. Help it sustain us in doubts. Help it sustain us in hard obedience to Jesus when it's costly and when it's difficult and when nothing in us wants to do it, Lord. Help the certainty that you give us, Lord, lead us to share the gospel with others. And help us follow you faithfully in faith that is based on the certainty of your word. We ask these things for the glory of Jesus, everyone said. Amen.